The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with the Interesting People podcast. My guest is Veronique Rivet. It would take so long to go through all of her accomplishments, but best sommelier in Canada twice, came in second in the world competition back in 2013. Also, many wine bars in Gatineau. She's a teacher, a writer, an instructor. Veronique, thank you so much for being a part of the podcast.
Hi, pleasure to be there, Matthew. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, if you were at a cocktail party meeting someone, and they, you know, did the question where we always ask, so what do you do? Like, for someone that does, you know, your toe is dipped in so many different areas in wine, how would you describe your job?
I was going to say my go-to answer is just I drink wine for a living.
That's a great answer.
I found a way to make, my bad habits socially acceptable. No, I'm kidding. it is. But I think it's a big part of why I like this job so much. As a student, as I was one of those people, I never knew what I wanted to do in life. I didn't have it clear. And because I think it's just because I'm extremely curious and there are so many things I find interesting. I was always a bit afraid of specializing. And wine allows me to do that, right? So constantly studying, and I'm doing geography and history as well as chemistry and geology and economics. And sommelier to me wraps it all together, although I feel also very strongly about the misuse of that word. A sommelier is first and foremost a server, and I've spent most of my life, well, still all of my life, working in one way or another with restaurants. As you mentioned, I mean, it's led me to my love of learning, has led me to teaching also. I've always done a lot of teaching, mentoring, and writing. My first degree I did was in modern languages and literature. And so I love writing also. So yeah, it's never a short answer. I'm sorry.
No. It, by the way, it should be a long answer. And it is funny with wine, you're right. It is about science and it's about geography and history and marketing and business and all these things in between. But the one point I think you really nailed there is that sometimes when we hear the word sommelier, we think highfalutin, snobby, above the crowd. But in the end of the day, their job is to try to bring joy to the people at a restaurant or to wine collectors or anyone in between. That's the main job, is to bring joy through wine and help people out.
Exactly. In French we say only des marchands de bonheur. We are merchants of happiness, in a way, right?
That's a much better description of sommelier, just merchants of happiness. I love that.
Yeah.
I was wondering, could you take me back to those early days? I know your first restaurant job, you were 16. I think it was in Ottawa, too young to obviously be serving alcohol, but what were those early days like for you?
That was right. I mean, I had no clue. That was not a career move whatsoever. It was a student job. My first job in a restaurant was at 16. It was in Ottawa on the Byward Market. And I was hired as a hostess, right, to greet people at the door and seat them. I could not serve because I was underage. But I just fell in love with the industry, the buzz of a restaurant, all the people you see, seeing so many people seated, having fun, talking together and, you know, catering to that. I just fell in love with it, but still, you know, as considering it as a student job and not, seeing anything else in it than that at that time. But I since then, I've almost always kept working in restaurants until, right? I mean, at some point, it was also, it's not very glorious to tell your family, you know, my goal in life is to become a server, right? Your parents have loftier goals for you, but It's really, really where I felt the most at ease, the most happy. It went from one thing to another. I kept working in restaurants, but then, as I said, I was studying. I studied languages and I did an MBA, but I went to France through all this for a year of study and ended up spending 7 years there, still working in restaurants, in hotels, and got closer, obviously, right, to wine. I mean, wine country is a bit closer when you're there. And right, we're talking quite a few years back where the wine industry was not as developed here. But and just one thing led to another. It's people I've met, and I ended up getting a job in France with a winery and stayed there for about 3 years. And then it really started sinking in that, hey, this could be, you know, it could be a career. And yeah, again, as I say, I didn't wake up one morning and say, I want to become a sommelier. It's just, you know, a series of jobs I've had, of people I've met, that slowly led to it. And, you know, I always say I realized that I really, really enjoy eating and drinking. Who doesn't? But food and wine, and again, their cultural properties, their history, their how they fit into society, how they bring us together. It just all ended up fitting into place and making sense.
Where in France? What was the wine? What were some of the wineries you worked at?
I was in Alsace. I spent 7 years living in Strasbourg. Yep. One of the most beautiful, picturesque regions of France, and of course, I have a huge love for Alsace wines, and it's a great region for gastronomy too. Right at the time when I was there, I think it had the highest concentration of Michelin-starred restaurants in France. I obviously was not eating in those restaurants at that age, but still, right? There was all that inspiration. I used to work. The winery doesn't exist anymore. It was a big winery. I mean, there was two big wineries back then in Alsace. Berger, which is still around, and Logel, it was called back then. But after I'd left, it was a family winery, but big enough, working with about 400 contracted grape growers. But it was sold to bigger groups, and yeah. So, but it was a great school. I mean, I was still small enough that I could touch everything, right? So I whenever I could, I went to the lab to be with the winemaker or in the cellars, always asking questions. And it was just this great opportunity for learning.
That would be fantastic. Hey, actually, you know what? Thinking about this, how often when you're drinking a glass of wine, how often do you imagine the area? Because you've traveled a lot. And I find I do this. Like if I'm having a glass of Rioja, I'll think about Spain. I'll think about where this was from and what the temperature. And I'll sometimes think about, oh, you know, this was from grapes picked by a person. Like, I don't know how often you do it where you think about everything that went into the glass. I know sometimes it's a casual glass of wine and you're not there to brood. But how often do you think of the big picture of what's in that cup?
So often.
Good. I'm glad I'm not alone.
I was going to say it would be hard to drink wine without doing that. But on the other hand, to me, it's not. It's the great joy of wine. That's the beauty of it. You know, that we often say wine makes you travel. And that's it. You just said it, right? It does. And hence also my love for wines that speak of a place, right? I mean, there are industrial wines out there that are made, you know, more as a consumer product to please certain palates or certain markets and you know, to fit within certain price points. And that's fine. There's a demand and a place for those wines. But what is really exciting is real terroir wines, right? Wines that have that sense of somewhere-ness, the ones that will transport you when you're smelling them or drinking them. And so you were talking about the place, but also travel in time. You know, wines are a reflection of a year. You know, What that year, I'm sure when we will be drinking wines from 2020, we will have a little thought for 2020 and what was going on in the world.
God. Yeah. I, you know, it's funny. I do wonder about that. I don't know. I haven't checked what this vintage was around the world. I'm curious. Was 2020 for the, you know, Bordeaux and Burgundy, Barolo, Chile, Sonoma, Oregon. I wonder if 2020 was a good, and you might know, I haven't done my research, if this was a good vintage in a variety of different important winemaking regions.
Yeah, I think we all had our minds on other subjects.
Yeah, exactly.
Following the weather in wine producing countries. But I mean, the challenges other than weather were numerous, right? I mean, when this all started, back in March, or all of the Southern Hemisphere was in harvesting mode.
Yeah. Right?
Then there was, I mean, it's all the ramifications. Some wineries had no problems keeping, on working in the vineyards, in the cellars. But then they were just sitting on the wine inventories because there was no transportation available. It was a bit of a complicated matter because of all the ramifications, again, of everybody involved in the chain, right? From the producer to the retailer. But I mean, slowly everybody kind of found their marks, and it looks as if, people have not given up drinking during that time.
Oh, no. No, I find, I think I'm the common person. My consumption has gone up a bit because you're not going anywhere. And also it's a way to soothe when, you're seeing all the negativity in the news and the real life tough stories. And also what I find I've been doing is just drinking more local and buying more from consignment companies and less from the LCBO, and trying to support, the Niagara, Prince Edward County region a little bit more, because everyone's hurting.
Yeah, no, and that's definitely one of the, right, there's always the silver lining to crisis like this, and that's definitely one of them, that encouragement or to support more local and to get to know. I mean, it's been the occasion for a lot of people to discover, producers in their own backyard. In Quebec, our wine industry is much smaller, right? It's tiny compared to Ontario, but it's been great to see the surge. I mean, 20 years ago, not a lot of people believe in Quebec wine, and today producers just can't supply enough of it. So that's really great.
Yeah. I want to talk about Bordeaux. I want to talk about your wine bar and wine competitions, because you've won a ton, you've been a ton, and I think the listener is always interested in just what that is like the day of. But, 20 years ago, I don't think anyone thought much of Prince Edward County when it comes to Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. And now, the quality is incredible. So I'm curious, with Quebec, in 2020, the Quebec wine industry, where do they hang their hat? Where, if someone's going to dip their toe in Quebec wine, what should they look for?
Oh boy. You think that would be easy to answer. I always say, there's, be it Quebec or Ontario or Bordeaux or France or Italy, there's good and there's bad everywhere, right? Yeah. There's not one region, one country that has the monopoly on quality. So, I mean, approach Quebec the same way you would any other region, read a little bit about it or try to find out about it, who's working how and who's doing what. But I mean, in terms of wine styles, even that's hard. I would have told you 20 years ago, well, we make great dessert wines, obviously, right? Late harvests and ice wines, and some good white and rosés. I would have never put my money on reds from Quebec. Today, there are very few, but some great examples of Pinot Noir, 100% Quebec grown and made Pinot Noir. I would have never thought that 20 years ago. And obviously, like every other province, because I think, every other wine producing province, and I think this is really our forte across the country, is sparkling wine. Mm-hmm. It's one style that every four province, right? BC, Ontario, Quebec, and Nova Scotia make extremely well. And it should become, a flagship for Canadian wine.
Yeah, you're right. The Nova Scotia stuff is great. And, obviously in a lot of parts of this country, we're just not going to make 100% Cabernet. It can't happen. We don't have the climate. And that's, by the way, that's fine. There's 100 other grapes and things out there. So, I'd be curious to try a Quebec. I don't think I've ever tried a Quebec dry red wine before. So I'd be just fascinated about what the Pinot Noir would be like.
Yeah, it's really exciting to see what's happened in the past few years, right? Our winemakers also have so much more experience now, understanding of the terroir, of the climate, of what they're working with, like, Cabernet Sauvignon. I mean, I know there's still a bit of it in Ontario. I remember saying from the start, I don't think we should be doing Cabernet Sauvignon in Ontario. I mean, it's too, right?
Yeah.
The most important thing is what excites me the most about a winemaker is when they really try once again to do something that fits with where they are, right? That piece of land, the weather and so on. I mean, we have some people in Quebec trying to make big, powerful reds. And that to me is nonsensical, right? I mean, it's, you say, you know, if I want Cabernet Sauvignon, I'll go to Bordeaux or I'll go to Napa. There's already well established, right? Why would we do something that let's do what is unique to us?
Do you think that's more of an economic thing? Like, oh, okay, everyone knows this grape, so I'll plant this versus let me just see what the geography should tell me to grow.
Of course. I was telling you in the beginning, there's also the economics of wine, and it's a reality. I mean, it's not all romance. And first of all, it's farming. It's hard, the hard reality of farming. And then you have to make a living out of it, right? I mean, wineries are not just hobbies for rich people. There's an economic reality to it. That's maybe more of a personal conviction. That sense of wine being an expression of a place to me is hugely important. And as I said, it doesn't take away from those who have a more, you know, productivist approach to, but then you have to have the conditions for that. We don't, even in Ontario, I mean, in Canada, we don't have the climate or the conditions that allow for massive production of inexpensive wines. And who wants to compete with, you know, countries that have that and that specialize in it? It's not sustainable. It's right. So.
Oh no, I agree. Speaking of the word competition, well, that's an easy transition. So, take me back to Tokyo, 2013, 5,000 spectators. You're getting autograph requests. It's the world's best sommelier competition. You became the first woman to make the podium. You came in second place. That is just such an incredible accomplishment. I just want to know, Vani, just what take me back to those moments. And let's start with the first time someone asked you for an autograph. How did that feel?
It's always very humbling. You wonder, right? Well, why would you want an autograph from me? But it was, especially in Japan, was quite special. And I mean, it was the best competition. It was my third world competition. Now, you just don't show up there and, or, you know, perform so well, the first few times. It would have been the best place for it to happen, like you said, in front of 5,000 people. There's such enthusiasm in Japan for wine. I mean, the biggest world competitions audiences I had seen before were maybe 1,000, you know, 500. This was huge, and it made me realize, a lot of the people coming asking for autographs or pictures were women. And it really sank in that, right? Not everything is perfect here, but in terms of, you know, the opportunities for women and their equality in society, we're still quite better off than a lot of other places. And I wasn't fully aware of that, you know, and especially in the world of wine. And so in Japan, with all those women asking, it really, and they were saying outright, you know, you make us realize that this is possible, right? We can keep pushing through. We can break that ceiling. That was very, very inspiring. Yeah.
Yeah. So then for people listening, I'd love to know first, what is the prep? What is your prep before going into that competition? And could you take us through some of the questions, what you had to go through, the wines you blinded? I think people love to hear about the X's and O's of these wine competitions.
Well, the preparation is a lifetime. and that's what I was saying. You don't just show up at these, right? It's a little bit organized like the Olympics. Every country has only one candidate per country. So the best sommelier of each country, there's between 60 and 70 countries taking part in this. And for example, in Canada, you have to have one to win the Canadian competition. To have one provincial competition to be allowed to, anyhow. So all those, right, qualification levels. And then preparing so many competitions are not just, you know, the biggest preconceived idea people have is that it's just about blind tasting. People are always impressed by blind tasting. But it's just a tiny part of it. All competitions are usually always threefold. So there is the tasting where you have to do, it's not just guessing what it is, it's doing a full analytical tasting, right? So analyzing the aromas, the level of acidity, the alcohol, the tannins, is it from a hot year, from a cold year? Did it see, stainless steel vessels or wood? If it's wood, is it small? Is it big? Is it old? Is it new? Is it French? Right? So there's all that analysis that goes into it. It's not just guessing. And then it's not only wine, but every other beverage alcohol, right? So the tasting could be of spirits, of liqueurs, beer, sake, whatever. So that's the tasting part. Then there's the service part, because remember what I said at the very beginning, sommeliers are servers first and foremost. It's not because you took a wine class that you can call yourself a sommelier. Right? And so service to, there will be, mise en scène. They will put you in situations, service situations to test your, right? And being a server is part diplomat, is part psychologist, is so dealing with, different customers, different requests, more difficult customers. How do you serve an old bottle of port? How do you serve a double magnum of champagne? Right? The whole wine and food matching, being able to be efficient and gracious and, make your guests happy, answer their, so all of those service situations are tested. And the third component, which is probably the most important, is theory. So you can have written or oral exams on everything pertaining to wine. Again, on all the subjects I mentioned earlier. So geography, geology, history, chemistry, winemaking is all chemistry, right? Knowing all the wines in the entire world, every single wine producing country, all of the regions, the laws regulating the production of wines in those regions, what are the grapes used? So, and again, not just wine, every beverage alcohol, the same kind of depth of knowledge on gastronomy, right? And everything is getting more and more complicated. I mean, when I started, I wasn't even aware China made wine. Today, China, Brazil, Thailand, India, they all make wine. At the World Competition in Tokyo, you were asking kind of wines or spirits we're tasting for blind tastings. It can be anything. So often it can be things, and since you're at the world level, it can be things you've never had before. There was a tomato liqueur we had in one of the flights.
Oh, really?
But if you're a real pro, okay. If it's a well-made produce, you should get the aromatics. So you'll smell something that reminds you of tomato, and then the structure of the product in terms of its alcohol level, its sugar level will, you can say, okay, this is a liqueur or this is a spirit or this is, right? So I mean, even if you've never had it before. In the final, one of the blind wines we had was a Chenin Blanc from India. So again, that's where I always say it's not guessing exactly what it is that gives you the most points. It's having a spot on detailed, kind of scientific analysis of the product.
Yeah.
And you can get most of your points even if you get it wrong in the end because you have no clue what it is, but your analysis in terms of aromatic structure and so on was spot on.
Yeah, no, it is true. You get the tannin, the acid, the alcohol, you start there and you build out a Chenin from India. that's mean. Okay, so I'm curious. Let's go to the service part. Do you remember, in any of the competitions, doesn't just have to be this one, was there one that really sticks out where they really tried to throw you, a super mean, they simulated a super mean customer? I'm always fascinated by that.
Of course, I would say almost always, they're not trying to trick you. They're just trying to reproduce things that happen in real life. Restaurant life can be crazy. I always say we don't choose our guests, right? Some are amazing, you're so easy to please. Others, it's like, oof. You have to do somersaults all around them to try and get a smile, or right? There's all kinds. There's very reasonable requests. There's completely extravagant requests. Can be anything. I mean, things that they did in one of the competitions, I don't think I was reading in this one, but I remember hearing of this because it was in the beginning of you know, we were seeing screw caps more frequently, and they actually they have special wines made for, and they had a wine to be served by the competitors that was in a screw cap, and the wine was corked. So that's basically, you're testing what? And this is done in a service situation at a table. So you're testing two things. You're testing the candidate's knowledge that they should know that, yes, there's other contamination possible, you know, TCA, so what gives the cork smell or right to the wine, can come from other things than the cork, right? So the chances are tiny, but so to test your knowledge and then to test your reaction. How do you, when something unexpected happens, how do you you're in front of the customer, you're opening the bottle to serve it to them, and you just realize how do you deal with that, right? So it's just that, and that's just real life in restaurants. It's not some wacky made up situation. These things happen. So it's all kind of things, right? If a guest that will knock over your tray or, right? And these things happen. It's all about, excuse my language, but when I'm coaching candidates, I often tell them, because some panic, right? And I say, listen, shit always happens. It's how you deal with it that counts. And that's sums up in a bubble restaurant life.
I wish I could have had that advice the first time I was doing my service exam. The flutes and the sparkling, it ended up looking like Niagara Falls. But I'd never worked in service before, so it was a humbling day. I'll say that. So let's go to your restaurant. I was there. Now, again, my French is horrible because I'm from Toronto and, you know, I didn't take it much in high school, but it's just Soif, the wine bar in Gatineau.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, good. You weren't there that day, but you know, I was glad. I'm like, good, maybe you have a day off. But just, it is a gorgeous place and it's such a cool list. It is a fun bar to go to just try different wines. And I'm wondering what the philosophy behind your wine bar there is.
Well, I, again, talking about sommeliers and their work, you know, I often say a great sommelier, a good sommelier makes a wine list for restaurants in function of, you know, the restaurant style, the cuisine, the menu, the chef, the neighborhood they're in, the clients they cater to. That's how a good wine list should be made, not a list of the sommelier's favorite wines, right? I spent my whole life doing that, working in different restaurants. And so when I talk about Soif, I say, but this is a wine bar and it's my wine bar. So for the first time in my life, it's really a wine list where I take total liberty of just showcasing things I love, right? So obviously I always keep customers in mind. But this is, for example, the cuisine. Right? Every restaurant I worked in, I would build a wine list around an existing menu. So if we did the opposite, so this is the kind of wine we want to sell. Okay, so this is the cuisine we should be serving. And so there's that. And it was kind of, you know, to me, a place where I wanted to share everything I love about wine. And in a very informal way. You were saying in the very beginning, you know, that there was for so long this image of this snobby, arrogant sommelier. That's been the battle of my entire life. When I first did my very first competitions, I thought, when I saw them, I was, I think I took part in the first one. But anyhow, when I saw the, you know, kind of the white gloves, and I thought, oh my God, this is so not for me. I will never succeed in this because that's not who I am. So I'm not only proud of having achieved what I have achieved, but to have done it by staying who I am. And that's, Soif is a big reflection of that. It's so devoid of any snobbiness or arrogance or, you know, I'm like, I tell staff, I say, if somebody walks into here and you ask them, you know, a new customer, we don't know them. We ask a few questions, try to understand what they like. If somebody tells you, you know, their favorite wine is Ménage à Trois and you roll your eyes, you are out the door. I have absolutely no tolerance whatsoever for that kind of behavior. And it's unfortunately what's turned so many people away from exploring wine a bit more because they feel intimidated because so many professionals, we should all do everything. And we, I mean, sommeliers, wine writers, wine educators, wine producers, our one and only job is to get as many people as we can to fall in love with wine and want to discover more, right? But for years, the entire profession has had the opposite effect, making people scared about it, right? As if you needed this special, and people are so afraid to talk about wine. When you ask them, you know, I often say, if I give you a dish, everybody will say if they like it or not, and most people will be able to say why they like it or not. You ask them to do the same thing with the wine, all of a sudden they freeze. And it's exactly the same thing. You don't need a special vocabulary. Use your own, right? If a lychee doesn't mean anything to you, but you think it reminds me of your grandmother's perfume, then that's perfect, right? It's just that whole approach to, it should be fun. Yes, it is hugely complex. And I just rejoice of that complexity. It really fulfills me, again, that constantly learning process, but it can also be enjoyed very simply, right? It's just that make it approachable, make it fun, because that's what it is. Stop making it too complex. And again, if yes, it is super complex, I don't want to dumb it down. That's not it. I just want everybody to feel that they have everything they need to be able to enjoy wine without having a PhD in winemaking or...
Yeah. First off, I love that answer. I love what you said specifically there about if anyone in your staff eye rolls because someone loves Yellowtail or Ménage à Trois or any sort of wine, then that's going to be intimidating and you're going to scare someone off. Because then they might want, if you don't scare them off and you bring them in and they try other stuff, then they might want to learn a little bit more about wine. And if they don't, that's fine. Everyone enjoys it, you know, sort of in their own way. And those industrial wines, they are important for the whole ecosystem of wine because that's how a lot of people, that's their first introduction into it. Not everyone's first introduction is some Premier Cru Chambou Moussigny.
You're exactly right. I mean, my first wines were Blue Nun and Black Tower, I think. So,
exactly. And it you know, and also going back to wine bar, and then we'll end with the Bordeaux talk. It must be so liberating for you just about, okay, this is my time to create a list of the things that I love. And you sort of hinted at it. There is a trap that a lot of sommeliers get into where they get arrogant. We're like, no, I'm just going to have my wines. It's like, no. If it's not your bar, you've got to serve the menu. But for you, this must be so lovely.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's a real treat, you know, and to the point where you should see me if I'm not at Soif for a few days or, you know, back in the days when we could travel, I would obviously travel a lot, you know, to wine regions and I'd come back after a week or 10 days and, you know, we get new arrivals every week. The wine list changes every week, right? So if I'm absent for a week or two and I come back and I'm like a kid walking into a candy store, it's like, oh my God, we have this and we have this and we serve this by the glass. That's so cool. You know?
That's awesome. Oh, by the way, one other question. Sorry, I was just looking at my notes. I'd love for you just real quick, a myth that you love to dispel about how when people say, oh, it's too expensive in the restaurant and just the margins and just how hard it is to make money as a restaurant owner. What would you say to people that complain about the cost of things on a menu?
Oh, boy. Matthew, I love that question because a little bit of me inside dies every time I hear somebody say that restaurants are too expensive. If there's very few industries where margins are so low, it's a real labor of love. A restaurant that is successful and that works well, there's so much work and love that goes into it because if you're going into the business to make money, forget it. The margins are way too low. It's actually not very healthy, not very sustainable. Our staff is underpaid. Everybody works crazy hours, and you never know. You're always on the brink of disaster because there's no wiggle room. And I mean, I take immense pleasure of just contributing to our little local economy here, to bringing a place that brings a little bit of life and dynamics in a downtown part that's been a little bit forgotten, to offer career opportunities to people who want to develop their love of wine or you know, would like to start a career in hospitality. That those are all the reasons that drive me to do this. I have an amazing team. I mean, it's tiny, but and I so wish I could pay them more, that I could, you know, that I could do more for them. But no, our margins are incredibly small. Listen, just for, I mean, I know it's the same in Ontario. It's definitely like that in Quebec and probably in a lot of Canadian provinces. We don't have a wholesale price on our alcohol purchases. Just yep. That. I mean, in which distribution chain in the world does a reseller not get a wholesale price, right? If we would get, you know, a 20% break on our alcohol purchases, it would save the industry. It's as simple as that, right? And anyhow, through the crisis, I've been talking with our politicians a lot about, you know, it's a great opportunity to pinpoint everything that doesn't work well and hopefully get things to move. But and for example, in Quebec, it would be people say, oh, but it would take away from, you know, money for government. Or it's not true. In Quebec, the restaurant purchases, restaurants, hotels, all licensee. I don't think it's much more than 10%, maybe even less of total SAQ sales. So, right? You give it's a drop in the ocean.
Sorry to interrupt. Just to add to that, because Jen Egg from Black Hoof Restaurants, she was talking about the same thing about that bars and restaurants pay retail. If the restaurants get breaks, they get to stay open. They get to give more money back to the, you know, to their staff. And eventually, then if they do better, then they have to pay more in taxes. They can employ more people, and restaurants help farmers and so many other industries around the restaurant. The government should be helping and giving breaks to restaurants because they are economic drivers in 100 different areas.
Yeah. Totally agree with that.
Yeah. No.
I love to hear that. And we have to keep dispelling that myth that when people say restaurants are expensive, it's just right. And you should see the few times I get comments like that, the long letters of explanation I write. I write it all out there, explain what the costs are, what the margins are. And I'm saying, listen, you want to eat at McDonald's when it's fast food? Fine. I'm sorry. That's not the model I believe in. That's not the economy I want to support. Like you said, we're supporting small local producers. Yep. It's a long...
It is. If we had more time. And so, yeah, my advice to everyone, if you can afford it, you go to the restaurants, you be patient, you be polite, ask what the special is, order a glass, and tip as well as you can, because you're supporting not just the person who's serving you the food, but everyone at the restaurant and all the economy that surrounds that restaurant. Anyway, we'll end with this, because a couple of weeks ago, and we are recording this on December 9th, you did a fantastic seminar on Bordeaux. It was on the Left Bank. It was on the eight different appellations. And I was just wondering for the audience, if you could sort of explain, you know, let's just start here. I said that the image issues with Bordeaux, because we always think of Bordeaux as every bottle is the price of a Camry. But I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about how that you can get good Bordeaux that isn't, you know, $500 a bottle.
Definitely. I mean, it's a little bit like the conversation we're having about the sommelier trade and sommeliers in general, right? Not every sommelier is an arrogant, you know, wearing, you know, that thing they have hanging around their neck. They look in the penguin suit and they look stuffy and arrogant. No, there's, you know, sommeliers in jeans and t-shirts. And even the ones in suits, it can be very nice. It's the same thing. Bordeaux is not, and our seminar we did was specifically, like you said, on the Left Bank in the Médoc. That's in the Médoc is where you have, you know, almost all of the Grand Cru Classé, right? So the big names, the big chateaus that do sell for a few hundreds, quite a few hundred dollars a bottle. That's a bit like the image, right? But unfortunately, we tend to think, a lot of people tend to, oh, that's it. That's what it is. No, there's some, you know, great $20 Médocs and wines that are, they definitely have a profile of wines that are meant to age, right? But they're, You know, what I said in the very, very beginning, that what I love about wine is this great diversity. It's the same in every region. And I also said earlier, you know, no region has a monopoly on quality. There's some great and there's some lesser good in Medoc, like there is everywhere else. But there's also a diversity. We should never make generalizations. We should never say, you know, Champagne is this and it's just this. Chianti is this and it's just this. Medoc is this. No, and that's the beauty of it. We're never done learning. And the Medoc and Bordeaux in general has been a quite dynamic region, right? The economy's been, it's always been a great trading place throughout the centuries. So we kind of take it for granted because it's always been there. It's become a great classic, you know, and we could call it like kind of blue chip Bordeaux in the Medoc. But there's always way more to it than that. And when a region like that becomes a classic, we tend to forget to keep on exploring. And nothing is fixed in time. You know, the climate is changing for once. The everything about grape growing, about winemaking is in constant evolution, right? And that's also the job of a sommelier or wine professional. We should be, it's a lot of work because there's more and more, but we should be really up to date on what's going on in the world, right? And I was the first one to admit, I also have, you know, this image, okay, Medoc is this, it's the great chateaus, it's the very expensive wines that age for 20 years. But there's also great little everyday wines that don't see any oak aging, right? That are made in concrete or in stainless steel, that focus on the fruit and more immediate flavors, but that are still, they taste like they taste because they come where they come from. And you can get that in a $20 bottle of Medoc, just like you can in a $200 bottle of Pauillac or Saint-Germain. Right.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of that. It's just keeping an open mind and knowing that there's much more to every region than just kind of the stereotype we might think of.
And the cool thing is you can go, you know, more the Haute Medoc to the north or Saint-Estèphe, and then go down to Margaux, and you know, it's only, you know, a certain amount of kilometers, but there'll be, you know, some differences in the palate and the nose. And it's a cool region to explore because within the region, you are going to get some different taste profiles just because of a couple kilometers.
Yeah, it's always really fun to do that with any wine region, right? But to do kind of a deep dive into a region that we tend to, right, describe, okay, this is what the Medoc is. But like you say, within that region, just, you know, a few 10 or 20 kilometers apart, you will find an even smaller distances than that. It's like in many, look at how Burgundy is all these tiny plots, right? That's big. Why are they so cut up into tiny plots? Because they're different from one plot to the other. They don't have the same exact same soil. Or, well, you have that in every region to varying degrees, right? And again, that's what makes it so fascinating.
Well, when you can travel again, when it is safer, I've been to Ottawa twice in the last year and a half before March, obviously. And I was pleasantly surprised and found so many great restaurants and bars in terms of the wine scene, far better than I ever knew. And if people can, they should go to Soif, S-O-I-F Wine Bar in Gatineau. It is just a delight if you are someone who's been in wine in ages, or even better, if you're just getting into wine. It's a great place to explore. And Véronique, I think you and your staff, they do a great job of making wine easy and making wine fun. And I really appreciate you taking time today. I have about 100 questions I never got into. There's a lot of stuff about Air Canada, Ottawa versus Quebec, so many other things, but you know, maybe somewhere down the road. But I really appreciate you taking the time to join me today.
It was my pleasure. Thanks again for having me. And yeah, hopefully, yeah, we will be able to welcome everybody again soon. Definitely next summer, we have a great patio. Should be back in business by then, hopefully.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.